This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We are slated to hear from David Coppé. He logged 9 years as an NFL running back, and shortly after he retired, he announced to the world that he was gay. He did not announce that while he was playing in the NFL, and his career ended in the 1970s. Much has changed, and now Michael Sam, the SEC Defensive Player of the Year from the University of Missouri, has announced that he is gay before his first NFL game. We'll talk about it with David Coppé. Also, neuroscientist Will Clower. Dr. Clower has a book that is enticing. It says, Eat Chocolate and Lose Weight. Did you know that people who eat chocolate every day weigh less than those who don't? That says Dr. Clower. We'll talk about it, but now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. Please call 877-217-5757, inkstershow@wrkf.org online. The news in the sports world this week has been dominated by the revelation that the best player in the Southeastern Conference, the best conference in college football for many years, Missouri's All-American defensive end Michael Sam, has announced that he is gay. His college career is over, but he hopes to have a long and successful career in the National Football League, and he has bravely announced to the world that he is gay. He's not the first NFL player to do this, but he is the first to do it before he ever played a game. David Coppé, he broke ground in 1975 with his announcement to the world that he is gay. This after a 9-year NFL career with the 49ers, the Lions, the Redskins, the Saints, and the Packers. And he is with us. He's been with us a few times before, but it's been a few years. And joining us from the great city of Los Angeles, the pride of the University of Washington, David Coppé. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
Doing well, David. And I know your phone has been ringing a lot in the last few days. What do you make of the announcement by Michael Sam?
Well, so often it seems, and it seems that it's been happening quite a bit these days, I keep getting recycled. And that's good, because that means that things are happening in the world, and maybe people's eyes are being opened a little bit more than they have been. I met Michael at a dinner party here in Los Angeles last Saturday at a really good friend of mine, Howard Bragman's house. And when I saw him there, when I walked in the door, he looks like a really substantial kind of guy. You know, he's really well put together. Now, he's not huge, and as so many players are these days. But he's compact and certainly at 255, 260 pounds, he's got enough of a package to make it work, you know. And with his credentials as a co-defensive player of the year in one of the best conferences in the country, I'll have to tell you to say that. I certainly think that he has what it takes to play.
How much of a distraction will this be? And if it is a distraction, how will it affect NFL teams who are thinking about drafting him?
Well, that's a great way to put it, Jim, distraction. Or questioning that, whether it is going to be a distraction or not. And yes, right now it's a distraction for him in terms of taking the attention away from what I told him, that's really, really important, and that's be focused on what you're doing, and you're going to have to bring it like you never brought it before. And I think sports people know what that means on the football field. That means to really get after it, to really be physical and to play ball. Mm-hmm. Now, people are saying, well, he's going to fall. because of coming out, falling in the draft, lower than the projected third or fourth round that, choice that he's been projected as. You know, I don't think that's necessarily true, but it could be. And there's a lot of players in the National Football League, and you can take a look at the Seattle Seahawks that are champions right now and see how many players are third-round draft choices or below or free agents that have made it in the National Football League. It's not necessarily how you're drafted. It's how you end up. And I can speak that well from that because I was told I was going to be, I was lied to by a number of people in those days, and Gil Brandt being one of them in the Cowboys organization, saying that I was going to be a mid-round draft choice. Well, in those days, a mid-round draft choice was maybe a 10th-round draft choice. There was 20 rounds in those days, back in 1964. Wasn't drafted. Now, I don't know whether because of the sensitivity tests that were taken or whatever, or the personality tests that I was showed that I was so sensitive and I was off the charge, which might put up a red flag or whatnot to the front offices. But I'd never been in any trouble, ever. I wound up being the co-captain of my team that was going to the Rose Bowl. I had all conference honors. I had back of the week honors against SC when we beat them to go to the Rose Bowl. I played 52 minutes that game. It was an incredible game. I can remember it like it was yesterday. I wound up not getting drafted. Mm-hmm. And of course, salaries were nothing in those days, but still. It was a lot of money off the table that I lost. And, of course, most people weren't getting guaranteed contracts in those days. You had to earn it. I didn't get drafted, and I signed as a free agent with the 49ers. And I made a team, and I wound up playing for six different teams, And although I didn't qualify the last training camp that I went through with the Green Bay Packers in 1973, I count going through a training camp, and I went through another training camp the year after that with the World Football League. So I say that I played 10 years of professional football. And Michael certainly has more of an opportunity than I ever did. But that's all he's got right now is an opportunity, or going to get an opportunity, I think.
All right. Well, you came to grips with your sexual orientation while you were in the NFL, not before. And you acknowledge in your book, and by the way, it is an extraordinary book written in 1977, The David Coppay Story. And I got my copy at Cottonwood Books. It's a fantastic read and a brave story. In 1977, my goodness, it created quite a stir. This was after David had retired. But when you were in the league, people knew you were gay or thought you were gay. Did that affect the way they treated you?
Well, yes and no, because they didn't know right away. I was in San Francisco. I never even... Although we played in San Francisco at Kezar Stadium, our training camp was down in Redwood City, and most of the guys lived right near training camp down in the Redwood City. But I never even went to a gay bar in all the years I was in San Francisco, ever. I was really focused on football. I was also focused on what people might find out about me, and that fear... really did motivate me. I mean, I probably, had I been a little bit more relaxed, I might have been able to be a little bit more of a finesse player instead of being called radar, which I'd look up people to hit. I mean, on the football field, or run over.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it'd be better. It's not a lot better to run around them. And so I think that kind of always hindered me as I played through the years.
Well, you spent 4 years with the 49ers, then went to the Detroit Lions, and the best player on the Lions in those days was Alex Karras, and he was a macho guy. How did he treat you?
Alex, using the word macho with Alex, though, it's almost it's not necessarily so true. Alex was an incredibly tough guy and an independent guy. But Alex was the most loving guy you could ever imagine. I swear to this day, if it wasn't for Alex Karras, I might not be here talking to you or be on this planet. Alex was a dear friend, and we lost him last fall. He suffered from dementia. It kind of grew over the last 10 years. Certainly when I moved up to Seattle, it was difficult to talk to him on the phone because you had to look in his eyes and be with him to really communicate. And so we didn't communicate those years I was in Seattle very much. But Alex treated me great. Alex knew the games. I had some games against the Lions that they felt that they could draft me and get good production out of me. But I just come off a knee operation in San Francisco where I rehabilitated it in 6 weeks, a cartilage operation. And that was kind of unheard of at that time, to get back playing in 6 weeks from a cartilage operation. But I did. But getting to the Lions in training camp out at Cranbrook, the same school that Mitt Romney said some of those, was teasing some of his own classmates. But Cranbrook was a beautiful, beautiful place. I tore up my knee in training camp, early on in training camp. And, well, I figured, well, the doctors will tell me what's wrong. And sure enough, it started to get a little bit better, but it was only very, very slightly better. And I wound up playing the whole year with a taped knee, and it was really, really difficult.
And you say Alex Karras was supportive of you?
Oh, he was more than supportive. He was almost like a big brother. The guys thought they would get at Alex and get at me by calling me Junior, meaning Junior Alex, you know. I was married at the time. Actually, I was married when I was in New Orleans, but my wife was still in Washington, D.C. I never was dishonest with my wife before I married her. That's a whole other story, but going through therapy and wound up getting married from this crazy shrink that, we can get into that another time. But, but Alex was great. Alex was meant everything to me. And we never, ever discussed my sexuality, but it was kind of an unspoken thing that he knew. He also knew, and he was kind of separating from his first wife at the time, and I could attract the ladies, and I enjoyed ladies. I enjoyed women's bodies. I enjoyed, but I wasn't necessarily really compelled to them the way I felt about my buddy in the service who I lost. Not then, but it was a few years later. Alex was just great. Him and Bill Munson. Bill was the quarterback of our team. He knew I could play, but I wasn't playing very well on one leg. But comes that the doctor, about 3 or 4 years after I went to work in Hollywood selling floors, that's my only job I could get from my Uncle Bill.
Hang on, Dave. We'll talk more about David Coppé and his remarkable odyssey, from NFL running back to gay activist, how he was treated, and how we're doing now. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. 877-217-5757 outside the area. Engster Show at WRKF.org. A bit more time with David Marquette Coppe, NFL running back for nearly a decade. Attended Notre Dame High School in Sherman Oaks, California. All-American at the University of Washington, led his team to the Rose Bowl, and then spent many years in the National Football League, where he came to grips with his sexual orientation and then wrote about it in a best-selling book, The David Coppe Story, 1977. So he was the first former NFL player to announce that he is gay, and he, at the age of 71, remains active in his world, and he recently met Michael Sam, the All-American SEC Co-Defensive Player of the Year from Missouri, who is awaiting the NFL draft and has announced that he is gay. Now, I want to get to your personal odyssey a bit, David. You, at one point, were in a seminary, right?
I was. I went to the Claretian Junior Seminary, but it really was silly if you think about it. It was to go to high school, not to go to the college. So it was a boarding school down in Dominguez, California, at the old Dominguez Ranchero, which was the original land grant ranchero of the whole city of Los Angeles. But I knew right away that I wasn't going to stay there, and I really missed competitive sports in a way that just spoke to me. And I decided I needed to go to Notre Dame High School and become the athlete that I thought I could be. Mm-hmm. And that started me on my way. I lettered in three sports at Notre Dame. I was the only three-sport letterman. And we had a pretty good team my senior year. We didn't have a championship team.
All right.
I got a number of scholarships, Cal, Stanford, Naval Academy, Marquette, University of Washington. I wound up going to Marquette. They dropped football. I went to the University of Washington, where I joined my brother Tony, who was on a Rose Bowl team. At University of Washington, I had some talent. I had some ability, and they started me as a sophomore. And in those days, freshmen weren't allowed to play. And, of course, I came after my freshman year from Marquette, so that didn't much matter. But I didn't lose any eligibility because they dropped football.
Right. Now, I wanted to get into what happened in the NFL, and you come to a realization that you were gay. It happened when you were with the Washington Redskins, and your coach was...
Well, actually, it happened in Detroit, but I couldn't face up to myself very well, and I went on to Washington, and then I met Jerry Smith.
Jerry Smith, all-pro tight end.
Right. I was told by a teammate of mine who knew that I was gay. I never really spelt it out to him. I spelt it out to his wife, and I think his wife told him, Walter Rock, who was a really substantial offensive tackle with the 49ers when I played there, and then he was in Washington. And so I went to he was telling me about that I was going to love coming to Washington once he heard that that I was going to be picked up off waivers from Detroit. So that's when I really started to find myself.
And Jerry Smith, the best tight end in the league, was leading a secret life. He was gay, and you ultimately became lovers.
Well, I certainly loved Jerry, but I wouldn't say we were lovers. I mean, we came home to Joe Blair's house. Joe Blair was the public information director at the Redskins for years and years and years after a long career at Maryland. And it was one night out of a party, and we'd been up to an underground gay bar in Baltimore. And it was right before training camp was to begin 1 year there. And I went to bed in one of Joe's guest rooms, and all of a sudden Jerry was in the bedroom, and we were both been drinking a lot, and looking for some affection and love, and we certainly did. I thought it was wonderful, although I never really was ever really directed or sexually that attracted, even attracted to Jerry. But I was certainly attracted to him as a person and as a football player. And of course, those feelings get kind of screwed up there, and you don't know quite what you're feeling, you know.
Right. But on that team, coached by Vincent Lombardi, who had a brother who was gay, you had a high draft pick in that year, I think a running back, who flopped.
Yeah, Ray McDonald, right. He was a first-round draft choice, 6'4", high hurdler from Idaho, fast as you can be. I mean, incredibly gifted, talented guy. But also very, very kind of affected. And affected, in those days especially, didn't work, you know?
You mean he was overtly...
Yeah, he was kind of outrageous in a lot of ways. And I wish he'd have been around when I got there. He got cut like the week before I got there for getting in trouble in a sexual situation in one of the public areas of Washington, D.C. In fact, it was right across the street from the White House. And it wasn't his first time. It was maybe it had happened before in his college career. I think he was only a rookie at the time. And to cut a first-round draft choice right away in training camp was kind of really an unheard-of thing. But, he had been given a number of chances. Trust me, Coach Lombardi... I think he had no choice because Coach Lombardi, I often wonder now whether he really knew about Jerry. I think because of the Italian old doctor that they had and some of the problems Jerry had, I'm sure that Vince must have known about Coach Lombardi. Must have known.
Right. Well, Jerry died of AIDS in 1986, at the age of 43, he never acknowledged he was gay.
Well, he was being coached up by Joe Blair, who was afraid to death and always saying, you can't do this, you can't do this, and you can't do that. And Joe was with Jerry his whole career there, the 14 years he was with the Redskins. So, of course, Jerry was very, very close to Joe. And there was another fellow, David Slattery, who was assistant general manager with the team, who recognized that he was gay just as I was getting to Washington. And he recognized that because he had lost just the friendship and love of a high school classmate who was, when he was killed in Vietnam, was the highest-ranking officer ever killed over there. He was a general. But he didn't lose the physical love. He lost the emotional love of the general and his family, who they were just good friends, but David always was in love with him. And he realized that he was gay, and he came out to Jerry and me and Joe. And so I had some kind of support there in Washington. And that's what I needed most, especially after leaving the dire circumstances of the year that I had spent in Detroit.
Well, that's 45 years ago. How has the world changed in 45 years? It's changed some, we know that.
Oh, but... it's changed big time. Are you kidding me? I mean, it's still changing, and it's changing readily. I mean, I look at the things that I've been able to do, and I get very emotional sometimes. I mean, in 1977, I went back and spoke in front of the American Bar Association in Detroit for the need of lawyers to change laws to include gay people. That never had been done before. I mean, I can't believe some of the things I've been able to do, and I'm so pleased that I've been able to do that. But and I've been selling floors and working hard as a laborer and a salesman out here in Linoleum City all these years, you know.
And you've done very well.
I have, and I... been able to give back to my university. When I retired, I had a substantial amount of money, and that's all pledged to the University of Washington, and I'm thrilled that it's going to the Q Center, directed towards exactly the Q Center, a place where kids can feel safe and be themselves, and I'm thrilled about that. So, yes, luckily I've been able to get all my parts changed over, and except you can't get your brain changed over, and I certainly am having a few difficulties with concentration and anxiety and other things, but I don't know if that's a whole lot more than a lot of people are.
Well, yeah, you wrote in your book, and this is off the sexual orientation topic, but you wrote in the book that you're a great special teams player, and one of the ways that you were so successful is that you used your head to tackle. And
that's right, and also to pick up blitzes. I mean, I was part of a study at the University of Washington, which is one of the most premier places in the country about Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment. And luckily, the brain tissues and stuff, they didn't show any sign of real deterioration. But on tests that I took, I didn't do so well on a couple of them, but I did well on others. So they just said, well, we'll monitor this. And then I got tired of taking those stupid tests. I didn't care about counting numbers backwards and remembering some silly lines that I didn't care about. But I've noticed that there is some subtle changes, and I'm glad that the National Football League has taken efforts now to really play the game a little differently and safer, and teach kids how to really tackle without using their forehead and using the shoulder like they used to do in the old days, keeping their head way up. And so I'm pleased with all those changes. You know, I'm also pleased that the National Football.
All right. I think we've lost Dave for just a moment. Go ahead, JC, and see if we can restore Mr. Coppe, who is a brave man. And in 1975, he came out. And in 1975, those kinds of things just were not done at that place at that time. And in 1977, he wrote a remarkable book, The David Coppe Story, An Extraordinary Self-Revelation. He's had a lot of people call him over the last few days. A nice story in the New York Daily News about David Coppe and what's in store for Michael Sam, the star player from the University of Missouri, who told teammates before the season that he is gay, and then went out and was the SEC co-defensive player of the year. Missouri went 12-2. Almost won the Southeastern Conference, finished fourth in the nation, had their greatest season in many, many years. And, David, we lost you for just a moment. But from in 1975, when you made your announcement, what was the reception then?
Well, it was pretty terrible from most places. Also, at that time, folks weren't talking about themselves or their sexual orientation without getting blasted by everybody. So it was hard, and it was very, very difficult. And but I was propped up by the thousands and thousands of letters I got, and the incredible support that I had from people like David Susskind, who had a national talk show, the first talk show I ever did. I felt at peace like I'd never felt before. So things have changed, and they're changing big time. And Michael Sam has a chance to do something. Then he has also a better chance to fail. And there's a lot of ways people develop, and sometimes people take the wrong path, and sometimes they take the right one, And we shall see how this all plays out. He certainly has the potential to play. Certainly had the attention of his teammates. The teammates had his back. I think he has an opportunity to become a good player in the National Football League, and we'll see if he takes that chance.
Lastly, Sherry, a listener asks, do you recall much about your year as a member of the Saints in 1971?
Oh, absolutely. I remember, one of the big things I remember is how wonderful Archie Manning was. And he recognized that I was on my own, that I didn't have my wife down there. And he invited invited my, he heard that my folks were coming in town and invited me over for dinner when he was, you know, the big star. And that, and he was always handled himself with such grace, and he was just fabulous. And look what how he's developed his own family and his kids. And I love New Orleans, and I have so many great memories. George Durow became a really good friend of mine, and I'm so sorry that George is having difficulties with the, right. that he is right now.
Well, what about the you've traveled?
Benjamin Morrison, another good friend of mine, and I'm still good friends with Benjamin.
Right. You've traveled the world, Dave. You've lived in many American cities. You played in San Francisco, Detroit, Washington, D.C., New Orleans, Oakland, Green Bay. Are there any cities, and you live in Los Angeles, and you lived in Seattle where you went to school, are there any cities in America that are better for gay people than others?
Oh, absolutely. And certainly, you know, New Orleans is kind of like schizophrenic in their because you know they celebrate in a way that's a sense of freedom, but most of the time it's super conservative, and yet you can kind of avoid all that if but New Orleans, I would say, it's still a wonderful place. The bigger cities, of course, are always more. There's more freedom in the bigger cities, and I think that you know that's shown that gay people are attracted to those cities. Certainly, what would all the rich folks do without their hairdressers and and decorators and everything else? I mean, we've been part of the fabric of society for years and years and years, and we ain't going away, and certainly now with the new changes in the law, I'm so pleased that I had something to do with all this.
Well, you definitely did, and we thank you for talking with us today from Los Angeles, where it's about 60 degrees on its way to 81 today. Thank you, David Cope.
Okie dokie. Thank you.
Take care,
very
my
much,
friend.
Jim.
Take care.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And the Metro Council, by the way, made a vote yesterday rejecting a symbolic gesture to endorse proposed state legislation that would remove anti-sodomy laws from the books that have already been deemed unconstitutional. They're unenforceable, but the vote, 7-3 against repeal. Those voting to keep the things the way they are, Chandler Loop, Scott Wilson, Ronnie Edwards, Donna Collins-Lewis, Buddy Amorosa, Joel Bowie, Tara Wicker, and those voting to change were council people Delgado, Heck, and Marcel. Only three votes to essentially get in line with the U.S. Constitution. And amazingly, two members did not vote. Trey Welch and Shauna Banks Daniel were absent from the meeting. We'll talk more when we return. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. Inkster's show at WRKF.org online. J.C. Kane is producing. Dr. Will Clower is an award-winning neurophysiologist, neuroscientist, and nutritionist. And he has written a book called Eat Chocolate and Lose Weight. New science proves you should eat chocolate every day. Good morning, Dr. Clower.
Good morning.
Are you kidding me?
Absolutely, absolutely not. In fact, there are a lot of new data, a lot of new studies that have come out, gosh, in just the last 5-6 years that look at chocolate, the polyphenols in chocolate, the constituents of it, and its impact on your health, your heart health, your brain health, your emotional health, from the standpoint of exercise physiology, and even in terms of weight. So, yes, absolutely, I'm serious. And also, within the book, what I show are the data that we have from, in my day job, like my day life. I run wellness programs for corporations, hospitals, and wellness centers globally and we apply this model using chocolate for people who are looking to control their weight and their health, and the data are in there showing how we go about it and how you can apply chocolate to make that happen for you as well.
Now, we've been told that sugar is not good. Chocolate
right.
has some sugar in it, doesn't it?
But, you know, you can candy up chocolate if you want. You can make it goopy with nougat and wafer and caramel and stuff. But dark chocolate has very low sugar. It's only the sweetened milk chocolate that's high in sugar. I think a confusion, Jim, that we have is thinking that chocolate is a candy, and it's just not. The dark chocolate, 70% green and black chocolate that I have, I'm holding in my hand.
Yeah.
As probably 0.8 grams of sugar in one little serving piece. That's it. Because it's dark chocolate, so it's low in sugar.
Well, you say, Dr. Clower, that you can prevent and perhaps reverse diabetes through eating dark chocolate. Can that be?
Oh, sure. The data show that the consumption of high cocoa chocolate is associated with insulin stability and greater insulin sensitivity. In our hands, the use of chocolate in association with your meals can help to stabilize blood sugar as well. So that's the long answer. The short answer is yes. Again, it's got to be low in sugar. It's got to be dark chocolate. And you have to eat it in control.
Okay. Now, most of us, when we consume chocolate, I would think most of us, myself included, we eat it after the meal. But you write in the book that we should eat dark chocolate before a meal. Is
yes.
that?
So when you have your chocolate, two things that it does that impact how much you're hungry for and impact how much you're going to eat at the meal are the cocoa butter in it can stimulate satiety hormones, cholecystokinin, and other things. That go to your brain and say, okay, I'm good now. Another thing that it does is that it can help to slow the rate that your stomach empties into your small intestine so you don't get spikes of blood sugar. It's more moderated out so that you're actually less hungry for overt amounts of food at the plate. And again, gosh, did you get a copy of the book from the publisher?
I do, and I've got it right in my hand right now. So is there anything I should be looking at?
Do you see the data that we show?
I do.
In the middle of the book, showing the reductions in what people are hungry for at the plate when they apply the chocolate. And also the amount of, this is honestly with tens of thousands of people, also the amount that they're hungry for between meals.
Mm-hmm.
By applying chocolate in this way, the number of between meal snacks is cut in half on average. The amount that you're hungry for at lunch or dinner is reduced by a half to a third.
Dr. Clower is with us.
Yeah.
Dr. Will Clower, neuroscientist. His book is Eat Chocolate, Lose Weight. He's been on such programs as The View, as well as MSNBC, CBS, The Dr. Oz Show in USA Today and on Fox News. And he's the author of The Fat Fallacy and The French Don't Diet Plan, living in Pittsburgh, PA, a great chocolate town. Chocolate's been around for a long time. Why have we not learned the benefits before now?
I think that the science changes over time, and when I look at healthy cultures around the world, you're right. I mean, spot on, Jim. They eat chocolate every day, healthy people. And I think that what happened with us is that we started sweetening chocolate and using the nougat and the caramel and the goopy stuff that people put in chocolate that you're going to get on Valentine's Day, and that makes that chocolate bad for you. It's only recently that researchers started looking at the specific polyphenols, the they're called catechins and epicatechins, that are within the chocolate and looking at the impact. So it's kind of renewed, the interest is renewed now.
You claim that the research that you have indicates that we can lose up to 20 pounds in 8 weeks by consuming dark chocolate. How often do we do this? Do we do it before every meal?
Before and after, as I talk about in the book. And, of course, the key is, I mean, we've already talked about quality, right? It needs to be dark chocolate. But also, we need to talk about quantity, because I don't know about you, but I know so many people who are afraid of chocolate because they think, sure, I can start, but how am I going to stop? Where's the off switch, right? How can you control consumption? The biggest part of what I do with all my clients is to teach them behavioral habits that help them do that. And one of the ways you do it with chocolate is how you eat it.
Okay.
When you take one of these little bites of chocolate before your meal, after your meal, and you put it on your palate, and you let it be there, and you just love on it. Don't even chew it. Don't chew it. Just let it go.
Right.
It elicits a response from your brain. It's called sensory-specific satiety.
Okay.
Meaning that eventually your tastes wear out on it. You don't want 12 pieces. That want is abated.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a neural response. If you chew, swallow, chew, swallow, chew, swallow, then you can eat 12 of those pieces before that response kicks in. And so the behavioral habits of healthy eating, the how of eating, Jim, it's absolutely critical to getting the health benefits of this chocolate so that you can lose those 20 pounds in 8 weeks.
Antoinette asks about blood pressure. Does chocolate increase blood pressure?
Increase? No. Sugar can help increase blood pressure, but dark chocolate, actually what it does is it can increase the compliance of your arteries. And compliance means the stretchability. In other words, if you have spikes in blood pressure because you got up in the morning or you're straining or whatever, your blood vessels need to be able to expand with that changing pressure so the blood doesn't poke through there and you get a stroke. High cocoa chocolate does exactly that. It makes it more expandable so that you are less likely to get a stroke, and it mitigates the blood pressure.
Okay.
So that's the long answer. Short answer is yes, it does.
All right, so you're saying it's good for blood pressure.
It is good for blood pressure.
Now, a research group in Italy, since we are in Valentine's Day Eve, correlated women's chocolate consumption with their sexual activity. What did they find?
When I looked at the data, what I found is that the data is decidedly mixed. There's some groups that find that that chocolate can make people more amorous, and there's other people who say there's no effect at all here. So, as a science person, I have to say that the jury is still out on that one. What I do know is that there's a definite psychological effect. You love the chocolate. And so if you're going to give your honey some chocolate for Valentine's Day, you can't count on the chocolate to do all your work for you. You're going to have to romance her up a little bit.
Okay, so chocolate may not be great for everything. You say actually a more accurate predictor of healthy sexuality is found in women who enjoy the moderate consumption of red wine.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And, gosh, if you combine red wine with the chocolate, then bonus.
Your blood pressure is going to be better. Your sex life is going to be better, and you're going to lose weight, and you're going to reverse your diabetes.
Absolutely. Did you see the success stories?
Yeah.
Our book, these are all people from our corporate wellness programs, and I just honestly, I love these people. They're all good people, and just normal folks that applied the chocolate in this way. And, like, the first one in there, Michelle,
yes,
100 pounds. This woman came to me uncontrolled diabetic. And her A1Cs are down to 6. Her glucose went from an average of 300 to under 100, where it belongs, and lost over 100 pounds. And she's just she's a good friend. She lives here in Pittsburgh. She's an example, like the other ones.
Yeah.
Guys, girls, all of them.
Well, a few years ago, several of my friends got on this Ideal Protein kick and did very well, lost a lot of weight, but some of them have gained quite a bit of the weight back. What about chocolate? Is this something, if you're going to lose the 20 pounds in 8 weeks, are you going to gain it right back in the next 8 weeks?
What I'm going to do in this book is not just throw chocolate at you. Like, check the end of each chapter while you have it open. At the end of each chapter, I have something called Take the Chocolate Challenge. And that, each one of those, is me teaching you the behavioral habits that you need to learn to live a healthy life. Now, those behavioral habits, they apply to chocolate, but they also apply to everything you're eating. So if you want to live a healthy life and have those healthy eating behaviors that are expressed through your behaviors, you don't have to remember them. It's who you are. That's what you do. Take the chocolate challenge. At the end of each chapter, the reason why, and this gets back to your question, Jim, the reason why this lasts beyond the tenure of the program is because you do build those healthy behaviors. And when the behaviors are expressed without you even having to think about it, then you're not on some dumb diet. You're just living your life. That's our goal. That's what we're going to do together. In Eat Chocolate, Lose Weight.
Eat Chocolate, Lose Weight. It has more than 40 chocolate recipes, by the way, and as Dr. Clower noted, some success stories. People have lost over 100 pounds. Do you practice what you preach?
Oh, I practice, I preach, I eat my chocolate every day. It's good. I got this, like I said, I got this green, black, organic 70% chocolate.
Where do you get your chocolate?
Grocery store, standard grocery store.
Just a regular grocery store.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, by the way, a lot of the recipes in there incorporate cocoa into what you're eating. Now, any savory thing that you're making is beautiful with cocoa, that you can just add the cocoa powder right to it. any sort of chili, your gumbo, whatever you're making, if you add a tablespoon of the cocoa to it, it deepens the flavor and enriches it, and you get all those healthy antioxidants with the cocoa. It's brilliant, actually.
All right. Nicholas on Nicholson says, we all know that everything should be done in moderation. Does Dr. our guest, our esteemed guest, as Dr. Clower writes, Nicholas, have stocks in Hershey or other chocolate companies?
You know, that's the second time I've been asked that. I do not. Absolutely not. But if Hershey wants to come and give me $5 million to stand up on TV, I'd be willing to listen.
Well, you'd be a good ambassador.
Yeah, right?
Right. Now, among other things, okay, we're going to lose 20 pounds at least. Yep. We're going to reverse diabetes if we have it. We're going to have a better sex life. What about energy? This could be better than testosterone, right?
Yes, and the reason why is this, and again, I'm a scientist. This is about the data. This is about the research. And all this is stuff that's happened in the last 5 years. This is brand new. If you have high cocoa chocolate, the catechins that are the specific species of polyphenols in this, what they do is, they can increase the vascularization of your muscle tissue. In other words, more capillaries can grow into your muscle tissue, not just skeletal muscle, also cardiac muscle for your heart. So if you've got more blood vessels in there, you have more oxygenation, you have more nutrients, and because of that, you get more of the little things that make the energy. It's called mitochondria. You can get more of those, and those become more efficient at creating energy. That's what happens when you have high cocoa chocolate. And the upshot of that is that people have a higher basal metabolic rate. So you're burning, you create more energy in the background. And for if you're working out or walking or just living your life, you have what they call a higher time to exhaustion. In other words, get more energy so you can go further in your workout, when you're playing basketball, when you're just walking around. You have more energy, so you can burn more calories, and that's part of where the weight loss comes from. And that's the high cocoa chocolate. Dude,
it is.
Adds to the list of reasons why this is a good idea.
Well, thank you, Dr. Clower. His book is Eat Chocolate, Lose Weight. New science proves you should eat chocolate every day. And Dr. Clower, a neuroscientist, says we should eat it several times a day. Dark chocolate. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be back tomorrow for J.C. Kane. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.